It's really a pleasure to be with you. I like to do a lot of this in a dialogue. If there are questions that you have, especially in this first part around information, because some of this stuff, some of it's familiar. I read the articles that you've been reading, and so some of the stuff is familiar, especially in terms of the historical stuff, and I hope to also present a different perspective. Let me just share with you a little bit about me so that you kind of know who I am. I grew up as a Catholic by tradition. My parents were from New York, and one of six children, Irish Italian, so real traditional. But the biggest quest for me, and things that I never knew about and that I struggled with horribly in my childhood, was a fear of God, boredom with the church, fear of my own sexuality, because I didn't find out until years and years later that I was a child of an alcoholic home. And basically what that meant was is that there was really no communicating and no talking. We never learned about sexuality. So when I went through puberty, it was a horribly, horribly difficult time for me, because it was both on the one hand fascinating and exciting, on the other hand it was filled with guilt and fear of exposure, because I was also at that point of time in a Catholic school. You know, so I have wet dreams by night and nuns telling me I was going to hell if I was doing that stuff in the morning. Go and grab a spot. There are chairs behind there, I think. And then right, and grab the floor.
One chair can go right there in front of the bookcase.
Come over here.
Yeah. The kitchen did ask me, I'll tell you. If they had asked a little earlier, we could have thought about it, but they wanted
this
to.
This is fun.
There's some other floor.
I guess a part of the growing issue for me was that, for example, in the eighth grade, I had a nun who was telling us about vocations and all of that kind of stuff, and saying that if you didn't choose the right vocation, you'd go to hell. And then she took me up to the seminary four times. So I presumed I knew what she wanted for me. But it was horrible at that time, at the age of 13, to try to make a decision between God and the little blonde sitting next to me that had all my hormones going. Same, you know. And yet, you know, as silly as that may sound as adults, as a child, I took that seriously. I was hearing this stuff, and I was absorbing this stuff, and I was horrified. Plus, with all of the rigid structural teachings of the church, especially around sexuality, it was a devastating time for me, because a part of it was, it's like going to confession Saturday afternoon, having lots of impure thoughts Saturday afternoon to evening, and then going to church and in a personal conflict over whether I had the right to receive communion, because of the thoughts, because my mind was just exploding in terms of relationships and body and hormones and pictures and TV and fantasy, and there was no healthy structure for me in any of that, and that ultimately led me to, as an adolescent, to a lot of, because I never learned what intimacy and closeness and family and relationship was, being really sexually active as a teenager and into my young adulthood, going through series of relationship after relationship, never being satisfied, broken relationships, a horrible feeling of inadequacy, developing a personality that on the outside was maybe energetic and charming and whatever I tried to make it look like, but inside being terrified that somebody would really know how confused and how messed up and how guilty and how inadequate I felt as a person. That even ultimately led to a marriage. I was married, I was 23, but I was maybe 13, 14 emotionally. I had no concept of what I was getting into. And that was an incredibly painful time. And it really wasn't until I had spent, after high school, I was pretty much bored with church, so I left. Didn't go back until 29, and I walked over one day after I had gotten a divorce and I had quit a job. I was working at a college as a professor. I quit my job and I'd literally sold everything and gone to the mountains of Colorado to meditate. And I'd spent 6 months there. When I came back, I walked over to the very same church that I was getting all those messages in, and found a new people. I had a chance to sit down with a gay deacon, and we just talked about where is church, where is God. And that was kind of a coming home process for me. I ended up being hired there as a youth minister. I was there for 4.5 years, had a chance to do doctoral work there, and also got involved with ministry to divorced and separated as a part of an organization called Beginning Experience, which is an encounter type weekend for divorced, separated, and widowed. And I'd been a part of that organization for 10 years. But it was in that coming home, it was kind of, I had my desert experience and I had been out in the wasteland. And when I came back this time, it was exciting for me because there were people in the church willing to hear and willing to listen. And I had a whole new exposure. And I guess the biggest part of it, I was really terrified when I went. I was in a doctorate ministries program, and I was afraid because they were all priests and nuns except for me. And I was concerned because I didn't have the theological background. And yet the whole focus of that doctoral program, I was going there in search of theology to validate my reality, and they were there with all their theology background searching for reality to validate their theology. And I became kind of a leader in that program, and that was a real validation for who I am, that finally church and humanity are beginning to heal the split that's been going on for thousands and thousands of years. And that's a little of the content of where my comments are going today, because I think we're involved in a real exciting age at this point. And a part of the excitement of that age is that we're in a tremendous period of transformation. We're in an explosion of knowledge and information. And we're finally beginning to broaden ourselves to begin to look at the bigger perceptions and things that seem so separate and so far apart, now are beginning to validate one another. And that's, you know, that's part of the good news to me, part of the excitement that there's a way that this all balances itself out and comes together and brings a new light of hope. Just to kind of start with, and a part of looking at those articles is that a lot of information on sexuality is really trying to go back and take a look at the church as a whole and what's happened to the historical and acculturated Western church from the time of Christ, because certainly the Jewish traditions were a very sensuous church. You know, they were an Exodus people, they were a lost people, and their spirituality is much like up here, you know, that it's not just something you go to a building and sit in there with 400 other people and hear something from somebody talking to you, but it's a lived experience, and it becomes meaningful and validated because you're out chopping wood together, because you're wandering together, because you're creating, because you're suffering, because you're laughing and singing and playing. And that was the essence, that the Jewish tradition was truly a sensual spirituality. And that's an aliveness, because then, you know, Eucharist, celebration, prayerfulness has a context that we don't just come together to hear words or to hope that something out there is going to mystically get into our cells and cure us, but rather, you know, it really becomes communal, community, in the sense of belonging and being together. So that celebration was a time of bringing together and unifying, that in our fear as individuals, collectively, we can be validated and acknowledged and warmed and nurtured. But a kind of, part of what happened traditionally, as I kind of like to call it, as the church moved, you know, out of the promised land and began to expand itself up and around the Mediterranean, began to take on other kinds of cultural influences. And the most primary of those is the Greek thought and the African Manichaean thought. And Augustine was one of the dominant thinkers of that particular time. And while he sought and struggled with his own spirituality and his own sexuality, he began to make interpretations of that spirituality, began to kind of bring in a reigning philosophical thought mode of the day, and really was there at the beginning where the whole process of separation, kind of the Eastern Orthodox Church, some of the great writers of that church kind of look at the Western Church and say that the primary thing that the Western Church has done to theology and scripture for about 1600 years is added guilt. You know, that we created the doctrine of original guilt. They call it original guilt, we call it original sin. And a part of doing that was in absorbing the Greek philosophical doctrine. Well, first it comes from the Manichaean. You know, Augustine as a child lived in Africa. And a part of the Manichaean religion there at that time was a real focus on a god of darkness and a god of light. And the god of light was a god of ethereal kind of perfection, anything that was beyond materiality. And the god of dark had to do with evil, imperfection, inadequacy, temporality. So it was really looked on at that time that what is part of the physical world was part of the darkness. And what is a part of the metaphysical world is the god of light. And Augustine kind of had that as a child in terms of an initial bringing. And then as he moved over and moved up and around and began in his ministry, also he began to see the Greek influence and a part of the logical thinking, which was a little bit more sophisticated than the Manichaean thought system, but it still had similarities, and he began to adapt and adjust, you know, both the religious teachings of the day with the thought process of today. Now, the impact of that is that what we were dealing with is human struggle, a lot of the human struggle, and that's a part of Christ was a true prophet. You know, I love the reading that was read this morning, Mary read. This morning is one of the readings that I thought about today. See, Christ, in a time when people were looking for true spiritual traditions and building temples and, you know, and asceticism, and John the Baptist is out in the desert eating grasshoppers and doing his thing out there, you know. Christ comes along, and he's a real passionate person. And he's real involved with the people, and he breaks all the rules. He breaks the rules in terms of saying, you know, man was not made for the Sabbath is made for man. You know, let the dead go bury the dead. I'll go talk to any human being, I don't care if they're a tax collector or you know, it doesn't matter. I will be there because I see something of beauty and value. Part of that reading this morning is part of an interpretation that I've always looked at, that is that Christ as a truly sensuous and powerful person, being surrounded, he felt physical energy drain out of himself. He he knew that he had made a connection physically first. And that's what stopped him. It wasn't a magical kind of insight. It was more, he's so in tune and so aware of himself. And that woman, you know, when he turns, responds, acknowledges that physicalness. And his response is, your faith has healed you, not that I heal you. It's more your faith that you are willing to be intimate, to be close, in the touching, and in the closeness, and that your openness, vulnerability, willingness, that's a part of the faith, your belief in who I am. So Christ perpetually is a person who shares with us humanity in incarnation. And yet as the church has evolved over the centuries, we've kind of lost that message. We kind of didn't really get involved in the true passionate nature of the Christ. And share a few of the readings as a way of understanding kind of the impact of that. This is from a book called And They Felt No Shame by Joan O'Hanison. She was one of my mentors. She was in the doctoral program when I first met her, and I've talked to her several times since then. She has a chapter in this book called Legacy, and this is a kind of an experience of some of what have been called the fathers of the church, and, you know, kind of the great teachers of our time. And what she did was go back and look through some of their writings and readings to really look at the impact of, as human beings, what were their attitudes and values. We understand all of their thinking in terms of philosophical perception. This is Paul. Thus, Paul's messages were wound around Jesus' message in order to preserve and protect it. They were threads that were intended to develop Jesus' message of integration and wholeness. They became instead intertwined with Paul's own taut threads of asceticism and virginity. Okay, in other words, one of the first things is to look at the writings of St. Paul, and part of Paul's perception that the second coming was imminent, that he truly believed that it was going to perhaps happen in his lifetimes. And so a lot of his focus in terms of his writing was saying, don't worry about all of this stuff, you know, don't get involved in too much of this stuff when Christ comes back. And that kind of message, as he was writing, we lose the perspective of what he was thinking in terms of himself and his time. And people have taken that thought and moved it and turned it differently. Let's see where it's... Here's some of the thought of Plato. Plato wrote that the true philosopher is not concerned with sexual pleasure. Sexual desire is a diseased aspect of the personality. The well-balanced personality is one who sublimates his sexual energies in intellectual pursuits. Okay, so you begin to see the dualism and the split of the great, you know, philosophers, the separation of mind and body, spirit and soul and material world. Aristotle, and this has a lot to do with kind of the attitude of women. A woman, he noted, is a mutilated male. The male is by nature superior. He commands and the female obeys. Okay. And again, a part of the arrogance, and as I'll share with you a little while when we get into perspectives on evil, you begin to recognize that this kind of chauvinistic attitude is really the offspring of what began to happen in the repression of women and their rights in the church. Origen is one of the great fathers in the second century. Origen was so intellectual and terrified of his sexuality that he took seriously the words in Gospel that said there are eunuchs who have made themselves that way for the sake of the reign of heaven, that anyone who accepts this who can, so he castrated himself. Tertullian, second century, saw materialism as the basic evil in the world, sex as the most central dimension of the basically evil matter, and women as the personification of the fundamentally evil sex. He not only blamed women for bringing sin into the world, but added to that guilt the responsibility for the death of the Son of God.
Mm. Women killed Jesus?
Yeah, that's Tertullian, one of the founders of the church. Epiphanius, and this is the 4th and 5th century, for the female sex is easily seduced, weak, and without much understanding. The devil seeks to vomit out this disorder through women. John Chrysostom. Should you reflect about what is contained in beautiful eyes, in a straight nose, in a mouth, in cheeks, you will see that bodily beauty is only a whitewashed tombstone, for inside it is filled with filth. Saint Jerome, the Jerome Bible, familiar with that. He had a number of women disciples, but they had to adopt a life of extreme asceticism so as to become a man. I praise marriage and wedlock, but only because they beget celibates. I gather roses from thorns, gold from the earth, and pearls from shells. A man who makes love to his wife too passionately is an adulterer. Jerome struggled with his own sexuality while living the most extreme ascetic life in the desert. Jerome was filled with wild sexual fantasies. Okay, and again, a part of it is looking at, and see, this was always a struggle for me, is that I would hear all of these wisdoms and teachings, but I never heard the history and the story of who these people are as individuals. And as you begin to unload and gain some perspective on their humanity, you begin to see how so much of their thinking is influenced by their own life, their own fears, their perpetual struggle. Here's St. Augustine. Augustine condoned marriage as a necessary evil, while admitting that sexual consummation produces the greatest of all bodily pleasures. Augustine believed it was dishonorable for Christians to seek sexual pleasure even within marriage. Marital coitus can be engaged in without committing a venial sin only if spouses are exclusively motivated by a grim determination to propagate. Since you cannot reproduce in any other way, he laments that you must descend against your will to this punishment of Adam. Okay, the punishment of Adam, and that's where the interpretation of original sin began. Thus the Bishop of Hippo advises a man to love his wife as he loves his enemy. With respect to the latter, a husband should hate his spouse's desire for sexual pleasure. To renounce sexual intercourse entirely was to hasten the coming of the perfected city of God. Okay. Now, don't you understand that Augustine as a person who had a kind of really tumultuous sexual life, he used to go to the Greek baths with his father as a teenager and would have erections and get embarrassed about having erections, that he would be aroused in these Greek baths and saunas, and nobody ever helped him understood that.
Well, how does anybody know that if all of his writings are so pure?
Well, people have gone back, and there are other writings that are available, but they're not published. So, you know.
Well, and it's even in his confessions he talked some about right. That. Yeah. No, he had his illegitimate child. He had a whole relationship that he talks about.
Right, yeah, he talks about, that he literally had an affair for years and years, and he was also a person who had a very strong mother and really struggled with his mother because he wanted to be married, and his mother wanted him to be bishop. And he became bishop, and had, he had a relationship on the side, and this woman followed him all over the place. And he struggled, and a lot of his writings in the Confessions, and what ultimately got assumed by the fathers of the church over the years, that this was a man who simply, and if you really read the Confessions as a personal story, you see that he is just simply trying to write out and express his honest turmoil with himself. The problem was people took that as gospel and then ultimately turned it into law. And that's been a reigning tradition for us in the thousands of years, the last 1600 years of the church. So again, part of sharing that tradition is a way of recognizing that, you know, it's been a very patriarchal system, meaning a male-dominated system. It had its influences in the Greek tradition, so we lost a lot of the richness of the sensuousness of you know, the pilgrim people, the Jewish tradition. And then it goes from Greece and all of that philosophical bent to Rome, and from in Rome, Italy, they learned the legalism, and the church became a real legalized phenomenon. You know, so Christ gives us two basic commandments, and the Catholic Church puts out 3,000 some odd canons. You know, as a way of saying that what's happened is they try to go into the mind, intellectualize. You know, the Catholic tradition is a sacramental tradition, so they have those seven basic sacraments as a part of the symbolism. And in one of the councils, I believe it was the Council of Trent, I'm not exactly sure what that council was, but marriage was added as a sacrament, mostly out of fear. And the fear was that, you know, that most of the primary sacraments and who were responsible for sacraments were the people of the hierarchy of the church, and that they were concerned of losing the masses. Because if the church was centering itself around its own power, how do we keep in touch with the masses? And that's where marriage became a sacrament, more out of a response to losing the masses and people going away from the church and losing the riches that might happen from those kind of denominations. Then what happened after that is, once you do that, then you have all of the legalism that then follows of what are all the standards and what do sacraments mean and how do we do this. And it wasn't until the 19th century, as the divorce phenomenon came around, that, you know, then all of a sudden the church was being challenged, because here was a new phenomenon that was creating havoc and turmoil, because it was being popularized, because people were beginning to admit the tragedy and terror of their lives. Sexuality was legalized and minimized to a one physical kind of as Augustine, and then that's the sadness. For so many years, Augustine's philosophy was the reigning philosophy. And that's not to say that there were not many other traditions. There were many people, many women in the church, saints, prophetesses, who were very sensual and sexual, but by the ruling body of the male-dominated church, that their writings were not acknowledged or published. And so that a lot of the sensual development of the church was there for centuries, but never really got exposed. You know, that we went more with traditional hardline, whatever came out of the Vatican type of response. Now, I give you that as a backdrop, as mostly informationally, to kind of help set the context. Matthew Fox, and some of you have experienced or read some of Matthew Fox's stuff, he talks about the major split in the church, that because we have been so guilt-oriented, so legalistically oriented, and have really created the separation of God out there, you know, and then you ultimately go to the Calvinistic traditions that ultimately suggests that this world is a kind of a place for us to do our suffering, and our rewards are in the afterlife. So it's kind of toe the line, put your nose to the grindstone, do good works all of your life. Try not to get caught up in the sensual, secular, in the secular world. And if you are able to deny yourself this, your rewards will be great. You know, so we began to really separate spirituality, theology, as God not existing so much here, but God as a metaphysical presence out there somewhere. And that, you know, that we had to evolve a life of trying to ignore and trying to avoid all of the sensory impact of the environment and the world around us. The focus then is on redemption and sin. You know, that we come into the world tainted, sinned as human beings. You know, we all have the original sin according to the traditions. And so our life is a life of somehow overcoming that. So we spend the energy in a tradition of redemption, seeing ourselves as broken, imperfect, suffering, all of the negativity of that perspective, and perpetually seeking redemption. And what's happened in that impact is that we have lost the perspective of creation. You know, that Genesis begins not with a story. A lot of people believe in that, you know, that the Bible begins with the Adam and Eve story. But that's several chapters in. The first beginnings of tradition are creation. You know, this, the creation story. And that's a part of the belief in kind of the dialogue that's happening in the church today, that we have a nature that is beyond just a fallen nature. We have a nature that is truly human, truly beautiful, and truly divine. And that's where the kind of a missing link of helping us to go back and focus on what is the beauty. Who are we as human beings? And are we to deny our bodiliness? What we find is we can't deny it. The church can't deny it because as they became more separate and more legalistic, people in the daily life struggle were saying, this isn't meeting my needs, and people were leaving the church in droves. So the church has a problem. The second part of it is that church in the Jewish time was a center that people brought their needs and their brokenness and their pain and their hunger and their suffering to the community. And then what's happened is that people now in their daily life struggles are dealing with things, and the church is virtually unable to respond to my humanity. So we need to go outside of our tradition and our spirituality and faith. And that's really what's caused a real separateness. Many people believe that that's what psychology is. When the church split, the church took on the metaphysical and science took on the secular world, eventually out of the pain and torment of people, psychology was evolved as a secular spirituality, a way to try to answer, you know, the human dilemma and the struggle of humanity. So that now what you experience and see in our culture, there are all of these phenomenon of you know, people coming together, adult children of alcoholics, divorced, separated, and widowed, gathering together, group therapies. In other words, church and community is evolving and developing in a different way, but it's evolving in a way that's beginning to center around the needs of humanity. Now there's beginning to be a healing, and that's the core issue, is that the sensual world and the spiritual world are not separate, they are one and the same. But we have been ignorant and frightened and unknowing of how to even address and to touch those two worlds. And that's the excitement now, is we're about a healing. So let me go from those traditions. First, anybody have any comments or responses to any of that overview of hysterical and historical stuff?
Did you say something about the Jewish ideas about sexuality? Or
well, we have to
pre-New Testament? Or
part in the
pre-New Testament.
Well, it's understanding that a lot of the Jewish traditions were family and cultural traditions. In other words, they're very survival. See, to be in the desert as a wandering people and to literally speak and pray to the God, pray to the gods because they need manna. See, it's not, for them, a part of the spiritual teaching is that it's not just some kind of ascetical presence and peace of mind. For them, it was hunger. It was fear of foe, fear of desolation. It was needing water out of rocks. Okay, so the Jewish tradition is very rich in seeing God work in nature, and that having to evolve and develop. So a lot of what is considered miracle at time has a lot to do with natural phenomena and a real investment in natural phenomena. Secondly, because they were a beleaguered and embattled people, that the communal resource was very important. So family, culture, community. So that usually the church, you know, the synagogue, became the central place of the community. It didn't become a separate place where people went to on Sunday. It became the central place, and that they would use that space, that communal meeting space, for community meetings, and not just spiritual readings. I mean, it wasn't just to read the Torah. You know, it was a time to gather together to talk about their enemies, their fears, the problems of what was going on. It became the center of celebrating with love, with passion, with the rites of passage. And a lot of the traditions in terms of their rites of passage of their young is a way that they validated the human development process as a part of the spiritual development process. So there's a lot of central interplay in that tradition. See, and we have tended to really get away from those things, that human developmental things, rather than being celebrated in our community, are ignored. I know in the Catholic tradition, things like First Communion, things like baptism, First Communion, Confirmation, those are supposed to be rites of passage in the community. In the Jewish community, that meant we celebrate as a whole community this passage, and it also is an expression of you take on a new responsibility in the community. Welcome to the community on a new level. So there's a real personal validation that happens with that. Nowadays, a lot of kids don't care because it doesn't mean anything. It's just something that you do off in this strange building. But what does First Communion mean? So what? And what is Confirmation? See, because there's a abstract philosophy based on that. See, but the lived community doesn't express it, because communities aren't really communities today. You know, if you go out into the secular world and you go to a church of 400 people, it's real hard to get into the passion and celebration of the Eucharist because you're with a bunch of strangers. I remember in the Catholic Church when they put in the Kiss of Peace. I almost said the Piss of Keys. But I remember the violation that a lot of people felt because they didn't want to be touched. That they saw church as a place where they went and had a personal spiritual experience, and they resented having to reach out and touch somebody. So the whole communal aspect, the whole process of human survival, growth, and development has been missing in tradition, and that was very, very alive in the Jewish traditions. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Where I want to go with this is kind of looking at a new perspective. When we talk about sexuality, one of the most difficult aspects of sexuality is that you can mention the word sexuality and people immediately think of 1,000 different things and perspectives. And a part of it is to really look at it in terms of you know, that sexuality embodies many, many different perspectives. Okay. From the cosmic perspective, we can begin to look at the phenomenon of relationship. How you and I begin to live intimacy with world, self, God, spirituality, community, body, nature. Okay. And this has very, very broad implications in terms of us as a people and our relationship to the world that we live in. Secondly, we begin to talk about cultural sexuality. And cultural sexuality has a lot to do with roles, expectations. That's interesting. Okay. Roles, expectations, kind of the stereotypical view. And a part of what we deal with here in the cultural thing is the enculturated value of what is male and what is female.
What does enculturated mean?
Enculturated means that we live within an existing human structure, and the attitudes, the belief systems, the values of that culture really infiltrate and really set for us a definition, structure, and boundary of who we are as people. So to be enculturated means that we accept whatever the ruling norm of the day is. See, and a part of the prophecy is all the prophets were killed, and the reason they were killed is because they kept challenging the cultural norm and challenging the culture to get out of its norm and to see a newer life. And the culture that exists in a certain way tends to be real conservative and really threatened by people outside. You know, when Jung talks about the enemy as an enemy and animus, and we have two different parts of our personality, a part that's traditionally accepted and another part that's beyond. And that's a perpetual tension and struggle. The third part of it has to do with genitality. Okay, so we talk about sex in terms of the plumbing, in terms of the reality of physical relationship, arousal, hormones, excitement, you know, the stages of different sexual development, orgasm, ecstasy, all of those different aspects. See, and the bad rap has been is that we have literally ignored this because of that separation. We have been heavily engrossed in this cultural phenomenon with all of its fear, emptiness, and bias. And that because of the general no-talk rules of our culture, which means that we don't deal with sexuality, we want to table it and put it on the back burner, and it's only for when you get married in the bedroom and you never openly, publicly discuss this kind of stuff. You just make babies, you know, kind of keep the race going and keep the churches full. Kind of because we don't do that, what's happened is that there has been horrible, horrible ignorance, denial, a lack of ability to understand. But part of what happens in denial is that when something so primary as our physicalness, our embodiment, is denied, then literally, see, our body refuses to be denied. No matter how much you try to ignore it, the body will throw itself at you. Okay. It'll throw it at you in pain, in suffering, stomach aches, headaches, migraines, nausea, fear. It'll throw itself at you in fantasies and dreams, dreams of power, sexual fantasy. It'll throw itself at you in arousal, no matter how much you intellectually think you have control over yourself. You know, suddenly you'll experience something and your body will react because your body is much more primary than your mind. See, your mind is a secondary abstraction. In other words, meaning the mind and its constructs and ideas. Ideas are a symbol of reality. Your body is reality. Your body lives in reality. So your body's going to feel and express things way before your mind is going to be able to understand it and control it, or attempt to control it. And no matter what you do with your mind, if your body wants to respond, it will respond. So what literally happens is that in our culture today, we have become obsessed with genitality. And I believe that that obsession with genitality and sexuality is a direct relation to the denial and repression of our openness and our ability to hear and to feel and communicate. You know, we have a $7 billion pornography industry. Madison Avenue knows, has known for years that if you attach sex to anything in advertising, that you increase your sales. See, so it's like there are people, professionals out there who are paid to tell us how do we get at people's vulnerability. And what these professionals are saying to the marketeers on Wall Street is sell it with sex. If you sell it with sex, people will really go for it because everybody's out there craving it. So we need to change our story, is ultimately, we need to be able to put this into a context. We talk about the rising rate of abuse, and we talk about in dysfunctional families that almost 80% of women experience some kind of sexual abuse in their lives, almost 25% of men. I mean, the statistics are increasing as we're, and when we talk about dysfunctional families, we're talking about families that have been identified with some kind of major trauma or difficulty, whether that be alcoholism, domestic violence, rigid religious structures that are often physically or emotionally abusive structures in terms of stereotyping. So the amount of abuse, the amount of rape, the amount of physical violence in our culture, we talk about warring, we talk about obsessive behaviors, we talk about sexual promiscuity.
Just change direction, that's okay.
We talk about sexual promiscuity, we talk about the high rate of divorce in our culture. All of these are phenomena that are pointing to, as a culture, we become really obsessed with sex, but we don't know what we're doing. We're in deep trouble. Okay. And so, and what we hear is we have what we call a generational patterns. What we are now recognizing in the field of psychology and developmental awareness, especially as we understand family systems, is that these phenomena, these traditions and behaviors are passed on generationally. Psychology shares with us that we absorb 85 to 90% of our parents' behavior, even if we say to ourselves at some point in our youth that I resent them and there's no way that I'm going to be that way when I grow up. The reality is that yes, you will. Unless you learn and are able to experience and practice a different way, you will become like one of your parents. You may not be like the abuser, but you may find yourself choosing other abusive relationships and becoming victimized perpetually over and over again. So a part of transformation, a part of spiritual transformation, is the ability to grow beyond. And we need to look at this tradition and look at this phenomenon and say, what can we do to make a difference? Okay, enough of the bad news. Let's get to the good news. I guess depressing to talk about. Comments? Am I making sense to you? Are you following what I'm saying? Okay. And we go to about what time?
A quarter after
with this one, okay. There is a new tradition, and part of the value of the new tradition, the excitement, I have a book here called The Universe is a Green Dragon. This is a guy I went to school with. His name is Brian Swin. He's a physicist. And he's also been really heavily involved in creation spirituality. He is the co-director of Matthew Fox's School of Creation Spirituality. But basically, one of the exciting things, and this was really a major impact book for me in my life, because what it did was it really began to look at a whole new different aspect of spirituality. It put the cosmic world, it put the real world back into back into spirituality. And the upshot of all of this is saying that we now have the scientific skill and awareness to look back to the beginning of time. We can still see the residue in the dust of the great fireball that started the universe some 20 billion years ago. And they have the instrumentation now to look back and to really look into the emptiness or the darkness or the black holes of space. And he says there's two amazing phenomena that really have a major impact in us recognizing. One is that we tend to fear the darkness. We tend to fear the darkness as a scary, frightening place. And yet what they experience is, for example, as they look at, they're able to see like a little particle, sunlight, photons. Okay? And they're able to look at the kind of electron patterns and things. And what they experience is that they can be observing kind of a little piece of space and identify the particles in the space. And then suddenly what happens is they'll look and suddenly what they'll find is that there's another piece. They have no concept of where it came from. It doesn't fit from any other part. It just simply pops into existence. And a part of the way that Brian likes to talk about that is the way of saying the darkness is pregnant with life and creation. That there is a substance and a structure that we do not understand, you know, with all of our limitations. But the reality is that things literally just pop into being. That there's a phenomenon of generativity and creativity existing in the universe that allows being and creation to emerge. So it's a way of saying that not to fear the darkness, but to see that the darkness is filled with life and generativity, that there's lots that can come out of. Now the second exciting part of the good news is what they find out is that as these beings and particles of light float around out there, what their experience is that they are really attracted to one another. They're really drawn to one another. It's called allurement. You know, we tend to call it in this kind of culture, we call it gravity. Mm-hmm. That everything is kind of pulled together. Everything is kind of held and bound and attracted to one another. And one of the things that he suggests about this allurement is that there are two primary things that happen when things are attracted to one another. As they come in the proximity of one another, that they come together in a way to either bond. In other words, they either attract together and bond and in a synthesis create something much bigger. Or they destroy. Or they come together in a way that they bounce off each other and literally annihilate their existence. So it talks about in terms of relationship, you know, that in the most fundamental scientific way, that as things are drawn together in allurement, they either come together in a bonding, creative way, or they explode in a real destructive way. The other phenomenon that's a part of this is a way of saying that when these things come in proximity of one another, when they pass in proximity of one another, that their being is literally altered. Okay? They are attracted to one another, and when they experience one another, they are altered forever. At the core of their being, they never remain the same. They call this, the scientific word for this is quantum stickiness. Okay? what we might say is the human name for this is sensitivity. That at the very core of our beings, we are very sensitive. We are bodily sensitive, and our sensitivity is fundamental to who we are as humans, as beings of the universe. What this also suggests, and this is a part of the change from the old Newtonian physics of the old ping pong balls and particles and parts physics to Einstein's relativity, you know, the essence of this is to say that all beings are in a state of flux, a state of a constant change, and that the core of who we are as beings is relationship. That creation is not a creation of separate entity, that we are perpetually in a state of relationship to the environment and the world around us. And that we are perpetually in our sensitivity being changed and developed. See, now this goes away from the old tradition of the ascetic person who tries to have a personal relationship with God and avoid the world. Because what a science is saying to us is you can't avoid the world. That being in the world means being attracted to the world. You know, we have that allurement. So that being, spirituality in this sense, is being. That I am in a state of becoming, you know, perpetual. So that this is a process. Our evolution and our history is a part of their process. So our embodiment is our spirituality. The core of the issues then begin to be, how do we develop a relationship to bond with creation? Or do we destroy creation, or does the creation destroy us? In human terms, you can begin to look at balanced nature, health, you know, cancers, denial, ignorance, pain, suffering, death. Okay. Both of them are a part of life. Well, what, you know, and part of how Brian responds to that in this book is to way of saying that the bonding and the creativity and the beauty of nature is much more profound. Much more profound for us as human beings. Because in spite of all of the distraction and all of the chaos and the destruction that happens in the universe, that the universe continues to create and bond and bring forth new life and new being. You know, examples being that, you know, like the birth of a star. A star ultimately is the accumulation of a lot of these photons and particles together. They become so dense and so warm it ignites into being, and it suddenly lights up. And then the star continues to compress upon itself, and ultimately it creates all of the other elements of the universe. But when it gets too hot, the star explodes, and it throws all of the elements out in the universe, and that's where the birth of planets comes from. So the star gets in on itself, bonds with itself, and explodes, but explosion is another form of creativity. You know, the Earth itself is very alive, that nowhere else have they been able to discover in all of the other hundreds of millions of galaxies out there, a body, a celestial body like Earth, like the understanding water. They can't find water anywhere else in the universe. All of the elements and particles to make water are out there. But the context and the relationship in order for water to be created and formed, they haven't discovered anywhere else where it's able to have the kind of temperate zone and the structure that water is alive. So water is really a precious, you know, a part of a beautiful creative phenomenon. Now, what is this? Let's get this down to them. What about us as human beings? what is the specialness? Creation, in the creation story, it talks about when God made humans. When God created creation, God said this was good, but when she created humans, she said, this is very good. A specialness. Okay? The universe struggled for 19 billion years plus to ultimately come to a creation of a self-reflexive conscience. In other words, human beings are the first time that the cosmos has ever been able to look at itself. That we've literally been able to step outside and take a look back at the beauty of creation. To acknowledge it, to see it, and now to begin to work with it. And to make it incredibly... So it's like we have a specialness, we have a divinity in the human creation that is both phenomenal, you know, is divine in its ability, but has an awesome responsibility. See, because now what we are about the task of doing is discovering if we have this power, what are we going to do with it? If we become obsessed with it, if we become myopic, very narrow, ignorant, if we seek to use it and utilize it for our own benefit, we can literally alter the course, especially of this planet. See, and that's the thing that you look at in terms of social justice, in terms of ecological justice and balance, the amount of toxic waste, the amount of destructiveness that we're doing is that we have a very myopic vision. Having the power we have as conscious beings is a true gift, but it's kind of like God gave an experiment. Let's see if we can evolve this being that can see the world, have power over the world, and see what they choose to do with it. Brian likes to talk about, you know, the whole universe is waiting on humanity to get out of its adolescence. You know, because the terror and the fear is that we can literally destroy and alter the structure of the world as we know it in our ignorance, in our obsessions, in our insensitivity. Okay. So we have a power, and yet we have a tremendous responsibility. Now let's move this into the world of human relationships, in terms of understanding sexuality. Okay. We live by a lot of enculturated rules, and part of that has been traditionally the denial of the body. The separation and the evolution of the mind to asceticism and to goals that go beyond this temporal world. And yet we still are body persons, and we have lived in ignorance and in denial of those body persons. And that's been the story and the history of our suffering and pain as humanity, because we tend not to live in a healthy relationship with the environment. We tend not to live in a healthy relationship with ourselves. We tend to try to control and deny our passions as human beings, rather than developing a sense of responsibility for who we are as sensitive people. Brian talks about evil. The phenomenon of evil as being one of two things. If we do not learn our body sensitivity, then we can react to the world in very dangerous worlds, because we see the world not as a being that evolves and that we are attracted to and that we can live in harmonious relationship with, but rather we see it simply as an object for consummation or for consumption to be utilized, and we care not about the relationship, care not about the sensitivity of other beings. In the human world, it means that it's real easy. For example, think about in your own sexual development, especially when you think of genital sex, that a lot of the teachings about sexuality in our culture are teachings that are preoccupied with objectifying the opposite sex. Finding your knight in shining armor. You know, for men, it's like, find that fairy virgin princess queen who will be a whore in the bedroom, you know, that you can have all to your own. We have a need for possession or ownership, so we don't see it as a shared responsibility, a mutual respecting of beings, but rather the tendency is, I got to go out and find Mr. Right, or I got to go out and find Miss Right. And then our whole ritual, you know, I like to call it the dating game, is a ritualization of manipulation, seduction. It's not go out and present who you are and see if you have something to bond in terms of healthy relationships. It's more like dress up, look sexy, tell them what they want to hear, give them all of the fast lines, go out of your way to charm their little socks off. You know, and the whole goal is, ultimate goal is in more, So you began to see that a lot of what has based on, now think about it in terms of a context like marriage or deep intimacy, if the basis of a relationship is seduction, or manipulation. If the basis of partnership is objectivity, that the person is an object of sexual conquest, an object of ownership, I want you to meet my needs. Okay. How do you suppose that you could build a trusting, intimate relationship when this is the origin of the relationship? See, but how many of you have been taught or remember being exposed to, especially in your early adolescence, that this is the way you do it? See, let's talk about how many of you felt like you got a healthy education sexually from your parents? What? How many of you felt you got a healthy education sexually at church? How about at school? How many of you learned your sexuality from books, magazines?
I doubt it.
How many of you learned your sexuality by experimenting? And kind of just getting a boyfriend and girlfriend and fumbling along, you know? And literally that's the way of the culture. You know, the culture says most of the early sexual messages were do's and don'ts. Share some of the things about what were you women taught about yourselves and your bodies? What were the messages you were given by your parents?
Real private. Mm-hmm.
Private.
Shame.
Shame.
It was to enjoy.
Just to enjoy.
Use it wisely.
Pardon? Use it wisely. What were the things you were taught about relationships, about how to get your man? Don't miss any of
this. Is this just parents? Is this parents or is this? Oh.
Parents? Yeah.
Nothing.
Don't trust men. Right? Okay. Be careful.
Be coy,
don't reveal too much.
Know yourself.
Yeah. What was what you said?
I said know yourself.
Know yourself?
Yeah. Be good, and if you can't be good, be careful.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. What were the men? Pardon?
My dad tried to get me to walk with my elbows and my wrists out. So I'd like that.
Elbows and wrists out.
What's that supposed to do for
you? Now, what were the things you women were told about men? What were you told about men in relationships? Told to watch out for them?
Not to trust them.
Don't trust them. They're out for only one thing.
Yeah. And then the woman gets hurt.
And the woman's hurt.
Use him and abuse him.
Yeah. And what were you told about yourself if you gave in sexually?
Bad person.
Naughty, bad person. Amoral. It's your fault.
You'll get hurt.
You'll get hurt.
You'll get pregnant.
You'll get pregnant. Things and the fear of pregnancy. Okay, now about guys. What were the things that you were taught about relationship, about your sexuality? See, and yet, in our upbringing, that's the kind of consciousness and that's the kind of process that breeds a sense of insensitivity, is that we work at developing a message inside of ourselves, and we get real preoccupied, and that's the death knell to so many relationships, is because people go in with expectations. They go in with biases in terms of in cultural roles, that guys get in relationships with women but expect women to live up to a certain stereotype, and if a woman doesn't fit that stereotype, then they'll reject her rather than accept her as having a choice to be who she wants to be. They expect things. People don't talk about sexual expectations or relationships. You know, it's like, be celibate until you get married. But then if you get married and you've never experienced sex and you don't know what it's like and you're terrified and scared to death, but you're supposed to open yourself wide up and it's supposed to be glorious. Mm-hmm. And for many people, sex in their first early stages of their relationship is painful, uncomfortable, unfamiliar, boring. You know, is that all there is? It's really awkward, difficult. They don't know anything about one another. There are lots of sexual problems that happen because of the ignorance and denial. And because we tend to put a lot of pressure that the closer that two people get, you know, the ultimate thing is the closer we get, the more we focus on this. Getting into sharing genital sex together. And if that's been a taboo subject, it becomes a real painful reality. And I can't tell you, I've been a counselor for 15 years, and the number of times that people come in with sexual difficulties in their relationship, and usually the sexual difficulty leads to other problems. There are other things. The sex is only an indicator, it's kind of a barometer. But a lot of times what it has to deal with is ignorance, lack of respect for differences, inability to know how to communicate and articulate those differences with one another. Becomes a real painful reality. The second part of this, you know, like myopia, or a narrowed, distorted vision, that we tend to become, what we experience here is a lot of, and this is a epidemic in our culture, obsessions and compulsive behavior. That we get real preoccupied in looking at a part as a way of taking care of the whole. Many times I've experienced, for example, guys in our culture aren't taught sensitivity, the ability of intimacy and relationship. So oftentimes what happens with guys is that they focus on sexual performance and the amount of sex in a relationship as being the barometer of whether we have a good relationship. There are a lot of women who, in the old traditions, respond to sex as something that I'm obligated to give. I don't necessarily enjoy it, it doesn't necessarily excite me, you know, because men and women are different sexually, and if they don't learn about each other, many times men are pursuing their sexual gratification with a vengeance, and women are totally dissatisfied, ultimately become bored, lose interest in it. But do it for the sake of, well, if I do this for you, maybe you'll appreciate me for all of the other things that I want for in a relationship. And so what you begin to experience is a lot of compulsive behaviors, a lot of loss of interest, brokenness. But people go on for years and years and years, and then they wonder at some point down the road why they don't like each other. They're committed, they've been doing this for years, but they don't enjoy it anymore. And they start questioning the value of their relationship because this is a real important area. You know, that when we get real narrowed vision, it's real hard to be put into a stereotype and to be expected to perform a certain behavior and to be denied the right and privilege to choose what I want for myself, what's important to me, how sexual I choose to be, and to recognize that if I choose to be different, it's not a rejection of you. It's more a choice of who am I. Relationships, relationship is literally a different phenomenon. There are individuals, and each of those individuals, before they can literally be healthy in a relationship, has to be healthy with who they are. They have to know who they are as people. Have to have a self-identity. We have this phenomenon in our culture called codependency. And what that basically means is kind of the old Dean Martin song, "You're nobody till somebody loves you." The belief in our traditions has often been that I am not valuable, worthy, and capable of excitement and fulfillment of and by myself, that I have to find Mr. or Miss Right, and that, you know, I'm not anybody until I'm in a relationship. And what that means is that we tend to bring a lot of expectation, a lot of our imperfection, a lot of our neediness to relationships. And this is a part of what attracts us to self-defeating and self-destructive relationships. Because if I'm real needy and looking for somebody to take care of, then the type of people I tend to attract to me, myself, are usually people who themselves need to be taken care of in one way, shape, or another, but who are glad to take what I need, but are incapable of giving back to me. They're glad to take what I have to give, but incapable of giving back what I need for myself as a person.